for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to offset some of the events or repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. And it is because of our effort toward getting straight to the root that people oftentimes think we are dealing in hate. We are oppressed. We are exploited. We are downtrodden. We are denied not only civil rights, but even human rights. So the only way we're going to get some of this oppression and exploitation away from us or aside from us is come together against a common enemy. Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you? And I, for one, as a Muslim, believe that the white man is intelligent enough. If he were made to realize how black people really feel and how fed up we are without that old compromising sweet talk. Stop sweet talking it. Tell him how you feel. Tell him how, what kind of hell you've been catching, and let him know that if he's not ready to clean his house up, if he's not ready to clean his house up, he shouldn't have a house. It should catch on fire.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Ashe. We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Munda civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. Report to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. Report to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Porta, Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour Ashe. We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Hayes Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John Henry Clark, John Jackson, Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name. Ashe.
The police is the enemy. Everywhere the white man go, he bring misery. All throughout history, look it up. Everything the ball has touched, they fuck it up. Every government is set up to be corrupt. rock.
Revolution.
Dead Prez, People Army, Steve Harley, Ghetto Youth Crew. What you know is who you are. Who are you? Do you know who you are in the world? What is your worldview? What do you go through? What has your life shown you? What are you learning in this so-called life? Do you have principle or do you blow with the wind? Do you want to be free but don't know where to begin? Do you know your enemy from your friend? Even your kin is deep in the skin. It's the system that's keeping us in. Will we survive? Do you believe or we afraid? Would you rather have control of your life or be a slave? Show me a sign. A pig ain't no homie of mine. They owe me what's fine. I'll show you if you owe me or not. I'm only concerned for tables to turn. When the people learn the truth about the system, the cities will burn. And I stand firm like Shaka Zulu. These crackers can't stop you. Century still poor. World war they want me to kill for. What happened to the future they always predicted? Between science fiction and things and space physics. I seen two sides, us against them. Police troops ride with 4 to 5 men. Prison business is booming, senators grand. People searching for answers, where to begin? Capitalism born from the backs of blacks. White folks relax, live off the kickbacks. It worked to the bone, yo, built this country. Further exploited by class to make money. Filthy rich capitalists with blood loot. Use mainframe systems to bank and compute with the next technology. Credit through the wires, internet, yo, demand more suppliers. Welfare, elderly checks and wage workers. All us, elephants trapped in a circus. Ain't fighting over man-made chips no more. When the lights go out, it's gonna belong to the poor. Ghetto Youth gon' rise up.
Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to another afternoon of the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. Thank you so much for joining us here this afternoon, this evening. We have a wonderful and dynamic discussion that we are going to embrace upon. We're going to be talking about a subject that says, I am not going to take my knee off of your neck, and this is why. We're going to talk about the police state of America. We're going to look at its construction, its development, and why it is not going to go away. So what we as a people will have to do is find methods that we can overcome that challenge. Any brick wall can fall, but sometimes we have to know the nature of it and understand its construction, because if we're going to chip away at it, we have to know, first of all, what it is. And so that's what we're going to talk about a little bit this afternoon, this evening. We have asked two very dynamic brothers that have quite often been a part of our discussion here, Dr. Bruce Bridges and Brother James Pugh. I see Brother Pugh is with us. Dr. Bridges is not with us yet. Hopefully he will join. If not, then Brother Pugh and I will deal with what we need to talk about. Then we have our community panel, and I already see you all online, so I know that we're ready. So we're okay, and hopefully Dr. Bridges will be able to join us later. But anyway, we are here every Tuesday evening, as you know, from 7 to 9 p.m. here on the TimeForAnAwakening.com platform. TimeForAnAwakening.com platform. And the Time for an Awakening platform is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And we have now been here and been a part of this system for over 5 years. And we're so happy to be, and we're looking forward to some more innovative ways that we are going to be able to broadcast the Black Reality Think Tank. We have other family members that are a part of our network, and we're going to talk about them a little bit at the top of the hour. But right now, we want to kind of get into our discussion. As you know, we are always mindful of our ancestors and those whose paths we follow and those whose shoulders that we stand on. So we always have to give them reverence and give them honor. And that's why we do our libations. And then we have to, from time to time, highlight those who stand out among our leadership and who are workers and who are examples of how what we must do in order to help the next generation follow in our path. So tonight I want to talk about a brother that's probably familiar to most of you. His name was Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin. Brother Rustin was one of the most important and yet least known civil rights advocates in the 20th century. He was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania on March the 17th, 1912. And he was raised by his maternal grandparents. His grandmother, Julia, was both a Quaker and an active member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. She was a part of the Quakerism movement and was the leadership in that organization for many years. Also, he was very active at the point in, with the NAACP, leaders like W.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, who were frequent visitors to the Rustin home, and they played a very influential role in his life. Brother Rustin attended Wilberforce University from 1932 to 1936 and Cheney State Teachers College in 1936, in each instance without graduating. After completing an activist training program conducted by the American Friends Service Committee, better known as the AFSC. He moved to Harlem, New York in 1937. And in Harlem, he enrolled at the City College of New York. He began singing in local clubs with black folk singles, including folk like John White and Huddy Ledbetter. He became active in the efforts to free the Scottsboro Boys, and he joined the Young Communist League, motivated by their advocacy of racial equality. By 1941, Rustin quit the Communist Party and began working with union organizers, A. Philip Randolph and A.J. Musty, who was the leader of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, better known as FOR. Together, they organized the March on Washington movement, which protested segregation in the military and African-Americans' exclusion from the employment and defense industries. Their protests resulted in President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issuing the Executive Order 8802, creating the Fair Employment Practice Committee. Rustin, along with four members, which is the Fellowship of Reconciliation, George Hauser, Bernice Fisher, James L. Farmer, helped create the Congress of Racial Equality, better known as CORE, which pioneered the civil rights strategy of nonviolent direct action. In 1944, he traveled to California to help protect the property of Japanese Americans interned during the war. In 1947, he and Hauser organized the Journey of Reconciliation, the first freedom ride testing the Supreme Court decision outlawing racial discrimination in interstate travel. After organizing Forrest's Free India Committee, he traveled to India to study nonviolence and to Africa, meeting with leaders of the Ghanaian and Nigerian independence movement. As a pacifist, Rustin was arrested for violating the Selective Service Act and was imprisoned at Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary from 1944 to 1946. Throughout his civil rights career, he was arrested 23 times, including a 1953 charge for vagrancy and lewd conduct in Pasadena, California. Rustin was openly gay, and he lived with his partner, Walter Nagel. And he did this at a time when homosexuality was criminalized throughout the United States. He was subsequently fired by the FOR, which is the American Federation of Service Committee. But he began working as the executive secretary for the war resistance. He had previously served as a member of the AFSC task force that wrote one of the most widely influential pacifist essays in U.S. history. It was called Speak Truth to Power, A Quaker Search for an Alternative to Violence. Speak Truth to Power, A Quaker Search for an Alternative to Violence in 1955. It's a very powerful piece. If you ever get an opportunity to read it, I think it is online, I think you would be very moved by that that writing. In 1956, Rustin went to Montgomery, Alabama, and he advised Martin Luther King Jr. on nonviolent strategies of resistance during the Montgomery bus boycott. King and Rustin helped organize the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But however, in 1960, New York Congressman Adam Clayton Powell forced him to resign from SCLC due to concerns shared by many black leaders about Rustin's homosexuality and his communist past. Due to the combination of the homophobia of these leaders and their fear he might compromise the movement, Rustin would not receive public recognition for his role in the movement. Nevertheless, Rustin continued to work in the civil rights movement, organizing the seminal 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom with A. Philip Randolph. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, Rustin remained politically active. Although he often shared their commitment to human rights, Rustin was a vocal critic of emerging black power politics. And toward the end of his life, he continued to work as a human rights advocate while serving on the board of trustees of the University of Notre Dame. The year before he died, he testified in favor of the New York State Gay Rights Bill. Bayard Rustin died in New York on August the 24th, 1987, from a perforated appendix. He was 75 years of age. Bayard Rustin. And I want to just add to that, that whole issue of being separated from Martin Luther King was not just Adam Clayton Powell, that was J. Edgar Hoover. And the documentation that is available lets us know that J. Edgar Hoover is the one that went to Adam Powell and told him that if he did not get Bayard Rustin to leave King, that he would pronounce the fact that they were having a homosexual relationship. And obviously that would have moved. And that is a written piece that you can find by Claiborne Carson, who wrote a lot of the civil rights movement in some of his research and what he did. So Bayard Rustin thought it was very good eye movement as we talk about the police state and what we are involved in. So as I said to you, the subject of our topic tonight is I am not going to get my knee off of your neck, and this is why. And so tonight we want to look at that construction. I will just take a few minutes and kind of give you some background to why this subject matter I felt was really relevant for us to discuss here tonight at the Black Reality Think Tank. As we sit back and watch the movement of all the deaths that are going on from police killings and shootings that we've been doing so now for the last, forever, I mean, since we've been here, but at least it's been more pronounced since this president has been sitting in office and has a lot to do with his apathetic attitude about things. But very clearly, this is a long history of police conflict and with the African community and Hispanic Chicano communities, very long prison. And one of the things that we know to justify that is the prison industrial complex, which is basically consisting of mostly African brothers and sisters. And so we know. And so the question have often become, we say, well, it's just racism. They hate blacks. They're just biased and prejudiced. Well, that's true. But there are other factors that are involved, too, that we have to take a look at. And it really goes back to the basis of history and how the American colony was set up and the way it was set up and the construction. And it's a very lengthy, detailed, discussion. And we are not, obviously cannot discuss all of that here tonight. It's just not enough time. But I just want to pinpoint a couple of things that are so critical. And this institution was set up, like most institutions are set up, not only on a physical basis, but it's first of all set up philosophically. It's set up spiritually. It's set up from, socially, financially, economically, and politically. And what we see is the framework of all of this that's put in place. And you have to go back, and again, you have to look at the why America existed, why it's here, what was going on in England and other places in Europe that made it necessary for this colony to be developed, and some of the impact of the work that was going on. All of that is tied in to the development of looking at what we call the Carceral State, C-A-R-C-E-R-A-L, Carceral. It comes out of the word of incarcerated. And basically means the prison state. The word was originally first used it was used by a French philosopher named Foucault, where he was writing about the French prisons. And, you know, France had one of the most intense prison systems in the world, that and Russia. Russia, the Gulag of Russia, were very powerful prison systems. And a lot of America's development of its incarcerated system came out of a lot of the influence from the French and the Russian prison system. And so when you set up a system like that, when you set up an incarcerated system, you have to first of all understand why. Why is that necessary? Well, most of the times it has a lot to do with the economic structure and the type of economic system available in that system. And anywhere there's capitalism, where there are people that control the wealth and who have their foot on the neck of the poor, not only just based on color, they have their foot on the neck of the poor. They have to have a way to enforce that so that if that group that they have their foot on attempts to rise up and change that, the system will be able to bring them to a halt quickly. Capitalism, as you know, is based on the fact that the wealth is in the hands of a few, and the majority are the ones that are exploited. And one of the greatest fear that the top has is that it fears that that bottom, which is the majority, will rise up and overtake its system. So therefore, it has to construct something in the process of building that society, building that institution, that will put that in check, so that the kings and the royalty and the church can continue to rule the wealth and the resources and the power of a society. Means that they have to be able to keep the peasantry in check. And when we look at European history, it was done that way for over thousands of years. We have to remember that Europe had this system in operation for 1,000 years. They imprisoned their own people. They exploited their own people. They put their foot on the neck of their own people for 1,000 years, ever before they went into the rest of the world. That's very clear and vivid history that anybody can follow. And so they practiced, and they learned very well how to build this system. And a lot of that was built on policing and prison system and incarcerating individuals. There are horror stories in Europe prior to Europe's engagement with Africa. There are horror stories about the imprisonment of their own people, as we said, in the French revolution structure that they had, how London, they said London Bridge and all of that, those were prisons. And those castles that we see that looked like they were the home of the royal, a lot of those were prisons that they were buried down into the holes of these places and were forced to live under the most horrible condition of their own European people. And so a lot of that is goes into developing that structure. But first of all, it's philosophically done as well, too. And we can read that. We have the option of reading that and understanding that. The reason why this is necessary for us to talk about, because many of us would like to erode that carceral system that we see operating here, that police state. Well, you're not going to be able to rid yourself of it because of the principle and the reasons that it was done to build. First of all, it has to get the approval of the people. And once the people approve it, they'll also protect it, even while in some sense it may not benefit them directly. The police and the police state is approved by the people. And how do we approve it? We approve it by putting in office people who approve it. And we tell them to protect it. And we tell them to do things that are necessary to make sure that nobody does this to me or does this to my community in a special way. And so you're not going to see that disrupted. You're not going to see the police defunded. That's just not going to happen because of the fact that we placed those people in place to make sure that this police state stays in motion. And so as a result of that, not only do we participate, we actually help make it go, and we help keep it going. So that is why we need to look at it as for what it is. There were a couple of writers out of England back in the early days, people like John Locke. The guy named John Locke wrote a book called The Two Treatises of Government. And then there was another writer. His name was Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes wrote a book on the called The Leviathan. And the Leviathan was basically a monster that was pulled together by certain aspects of the community, of the systems of leadership and rule. That's the idea he had. What he was doing was developing the framework example of how government is going to have to operate. And so you're going to have a Leviathan type of structure in place to make sure that you enforce the ways of life and the way the society should be ran by the majority. And that's the way it would be done. It would be run by the majority. The majority will agree that this is the way we're going to do it, and this is the way we'll do it. And that majority doesn't always mean numbers. There were other ways that they used and determined who majority or minority group were. And then the minority, obviously, would have to be forced to conform to that way of behavior. And those writings and that process is the starting of how a police state. Most of it was military. It was done through the military aspects of things. The army would do it. In the very beginning of the American colonies, most of it wasn't an army, because you got to remember those that were coming over here were setting up. They were independent. They didn't have a political system in place as of yet. They were trying to get ready to, because they wanted to stop England. So they would put into place some things, but the English were continuing to pressure and keep the policies and rules on those groups as they were settling and developing their colonies here in this country. And so what England did is sent the governors. They sent people they called governors over here. And these governors would rule the colonies and make the decisions based on the English order of things. But nevertheless, the people still fought back, and they attempted to unride and unseat those colonies. And they tried to do it in many ways. And that's the part of the American history that we know. And I'm not going to try to go into that in detail. But that is the beginning of idealizing and understanding how this police state comes into being. The people fought back against the British. They ended up organizing little small militia groups and small little militaries and to fight back. These militias today are called National Guard. And these National Guard groups are developed by the state. The state controls it. And then eventually, once the Federalist system went in place, they would then organize a federal military, which would always, always be in the same level of that. And then when the Africans were brought here and were beginning to be enslaved, they had to have a system for protecting them. And so they created patrols, runaway patrols and bounty hunters and all of those kinds of things that we heard about. And all of this was haphazard at the time, but over years it became more organized. It became more structured. It became more systematic. And they learned, because you practice over and over again, and you learn that you have to put in place all kinds of different ways and things. Not only just the police, you have to do it from the church, you have to do it from the school, you have to do it from the community, you have to do it in all kind of ways. You put these safeguards in place that all play into this police carceral state that we are talking about and that we are seeing operating right now. You got an election coming up. We're feeling that the Trump administration obviously is in support of this police kind of state too, but Biden is too, and Obama was too. Everybody was. They're not going to get rid of prisons. They're not going to get rid of jails. They're not going to get rid of courts. That's never going to be done that way. You will never end that by trying to destroy those systems. So what we have to do as a community is, first of all, we've got to educate our people how it works. And so instead of thinking that you're going to go out there and shut down the police or get rid of the police, is a waste of your energy from my perspective. Now, we can have our members that are going to come on and talk with you in a few minutes. We can let them give you their position, but my position is that you're not going to do that. And I want to kind of just real briefly, and then I'm going to bring them on. I want to just give you an example that, you know, we've had people that fought back the police state. Many of them are in prison right now as prisoners of political prisoners. They're locked up right now, been locked up for a long time. We've had organizations that have understood the police state, the carceral state system, and have attempted to try to work around it. One of them was a very powerful organization out of Philadelphia called MOVE, M-O-V-E. And MOVE, not only was it wasn't looking to fight the police, it was looking to grab, to take African people, bring them together, let them understand what the police state is and how it works, what this system of government and life is about, and create something new to do, live a different lifestyle, educate your children differently, understand religious ideology differently. And they attempt to organize their community and created a commune where they would do some of those things. But even when you do that, you are striking against the carceral system, and they're not going to let you do that, and they're going to come after you, even though you may put yourself as a religious system. And so they did that in Philadelphia. And it had gotten so bad that they even drop bombs on those folks and excuse me, and burn their homes and kill men, women, and children because of that situation. Hold on just a second. I'm going to choke in the middle of water here. Okay. So, the whole idea is that anytime you come up against the ideology of the of that penal system, you're going to pay. And MOVE was an organization to do that. The Black Panthers. The Black Panthers simply started as a protection group to stop the police from beating citizens, the community citizens. But the members of the Panthers were smart young men. They were brilliant. They were bright. They had a plan. They believed in doing things that were more self-preserving. They fed their children, gave them breakfasts, talked about ways to get kids off of prison, read books, understood the ideology of oppression, found ways to work on poverty. Well, that's a problem. The police state doesn't want that. And so they'll come after you. And you have to understand that the police state is not just police precincts located in certain avenues. It's your state militia. It's the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon. All of that works. Those are not just foreign entities. They are domestic entities that will come at you domestically. And not only do they come at you when you do something wrong, they come at you to make sure that you conform and control to the system of behavior. And that we have to understand. And MOVE was clearly an example of that. They bombed those people out of their homes. MOVE, the organization MOVE, was founded by a handyman. Actually, he was a middle-aged handyman. He was a Korean vet, and his name was Vincent Leifhardt. He was born in West Philadelphia neighborhood of Montawa, and Brother Leifhardt renamed himself John Africa. And those who joined MOVE took the surname Africa. In the years leading up to MOVE's official founding, John Africa had, you know, he began to dictate philosophies. That was maybe it. He wasn't trying to fight the police. He just, people got to live the life a little bit different. And so he created a book called The Guidelines. Very similar to anybody that's going to change a movement has to do. The Nation of Islam, when they started their organization, message to the black man had to be presented. You have to produce guidelines. You have to produce a philosophy. You have to talk about well eating. You have to talk about being able to not eat this junk that we are being that we are fed often in this city. So you had to write how to eat and live and some of those kinds of things. And the MOVE members limited themselves to some of the trappings of America. They didn't get into a lot of technology and television and radios. And they studied together. They worked together. Their health care was natural. The women were born, had their babies at home. And they were just trying to live a better lifestyle and create a system and educate their children in a way that would be productive for African people. Well, the system can't let you do that and conform, because then that way you begin to see that police state. What we are doing now, what we are talking about now, is a no-no. You're not supposed to talk about that like that in that way. But we have to do that. And so that carceral landscape that we are talking about has its origins all the way from the top of political power here right down to the local power. So even though right now over there in Kenosha, you're dealing with the Kenosha, and I understand Trump is supposed to be over there, it's more than just Kenosha. And there's a lot more to it, and we just don't have the time here tonight to do it, because I want to give some of the brothers that I asked to join me a little bit of time to talk about that. But there are other organizations as well. You know, you've had the Republic of New Africa. You've had you've got political prisons. I said right now, people out of Philadelphia, the brother Jamia, right now is sitting in prison because of conflict with who? The police. And see, police are just the pawn of the system that we are talking about. They're the ones that go out and they're up front. Most of them are ex-military people. They're coming out of wars that they've just recently fought. America has always been fighting ever since the War of 1812. And they fought a war, two, three wars in every century. So this wouldn't work. They've got Afghanistan, they've got Vietnam, they got all kind of stuff. So these guys come out of the military, they go right into police departments, and they're paid, and they're still carrying with them a lot of that battle fatigue and, that battle trauma that they bring into the community. And so they conflict with these organizations like that and have created so many different problems. So I want to stop here and go to our audience and ask them what they think, and go to our the two brothers that I'd asked to bring on. But I thought maybe it would be just necessary to kind of look at that whole the carceral landscape again, and understanding a little bit about how it works and how it is a monster, and it's bigger than just your local police department and your local government. It's a lot bigger than that. That's why a lot of times the weapons that you see them using, the type of vehicles that they drive, all have military backing. They're coming. A lot of them made out of Israel. A lot of them are made out of these South African places like that that were doing the same kinds of things during those years. So we will not see an end to this, I don't think. I hope. I would like to be wrong. I'd like to say that I'm wrong. You're not going to see an end to it that way. The end is going to have to come with us. And we're going to have to be strategic on how we do that. And we're going to have to do it in a way that we can obviously be private about how we teach our young people. Because if not, 25 years from now, our children are going to be dealing with the same matter. It's been going on since 1619 as it relates to us. And so we now, in 400 years of police and carceral state behavior, that's what we live in. We live in a prison system. So with that, I want to ask, I'm going to go right over to, I think Beth Bridges is here. I think I saw his number. I'm going to ask him if he would just tell us a little bit about who some of the political prisoners are that we are looking at and how they got into this carceral state conflict to the point that they have been isolated for years. And why do you think that they don't want them to interact with us? They didn't want some of the folks that were out there interacting with us. So they kill them. They either kill them or put them in prison because they don't want us to come up with new behaviors and new attitudes. So, Dr. Bridges, how you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm all right. All right, Dr. Rogers, what about you?
I'm doing good, good. Why is H-Rap Brown still in prison?
You know, because of what you just gave to the audience in terms of this system of capitalism and control of the bourgeoisie, I mean, control by the bourgeoisie of the proletariats. And when you when you were talking about it, you reminded me of the study sessions that we used to have in looking at the works and writings and guidelines laid down by the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale from the beginning, mm-hmm. and little Bobby Hutton. And they often talked about the history of prisons, of the prison system at the beginning of the Panther Party. And they would talk about the fact that the whole system, as you said, is a part of another system of capitalism, mm-hmm. which is definitely the case. And it coming, as you said, out of Europe and in the colonies of America and other places around the world, these are just, prisons are just reflection of the system that came out of Europe when Europe began to move out and to travel into other parts of the world. Right. And as we understand this, we will see that even the state or country of Australia was settled by men and women who had been released from the prison system in England. Mm-hmm. They were ex-convicts who settled Australia. and who began to build the cities of Queensland and Sydney and some of those other places in Australia. They were prisons, convicts. They opened up the prison and got them away from the society in England that the upper crust bourgeoisie were trying to build for themselves. And as you said too earlier, which I'm just really reiterating what you said, they began to go against that, and they were put in prisons in England, and so they got the idea, send them away from here. Put them out on the seven seas. Mm-hmm. Send them on over to, send Captain Cook and on over to Australia and let them take over Australia from the indigenous Aborigine people. So the founders of these lands and nations around the earth, and even America, the early settlers in America were people who had been released, right, let out of the prison system of England. Mm-hmm. So it's based upon a whole system that started in white European England, bourgeoisie sector of society, and then it was implemented in other places around the world. And and as you said too, Huey Newton and other people would teach on this and speak on this and try to make black people understand that, and I'm talking specifically about Oakland where the Panther Party was, he would oftentimes tell the people of Oakland that they were a colony and that the police were actually policing the slaves in the colony who were the black people who lived in the black community.
Right.
And then he would say that we, the Panther Party, are going to become monitors and we're going to watch over the policemen who are policing us. And that's how kind of how the Panther Party started. And we're going to have our own system within the system, but it's based on a system that came out of Europe. And another good point that you made when you talk about MOVE, and I get some of the political prisoners in this country, but MOVE was an organization too. And I can remember clearly, maybe in the early 70s and late 1960s, mm-hmm. John Africa, as his name was changed, as you said, John Africa had an organization in Durham, North Carolina. I should say a branch of his organization, MOVE, was in Durham.
How you doing?
And we thought we thought that they were crazy because they wore their own African garments. And they had a little commune up off Cornwallis Road in Durham, North Carolina, or Rockborough Road, Cornwallis, in the area of the Cornwallis Project.
Uh-huh.
They had their own food and their own philosophy, and the women had their heads covered. And it was called a Back to Africa movement right here in Durham, North Carolina.
What year was that?
In the early, so you don't remember, you
no,
you
I don't remember that one. No, what year was that?
But it probably, let me think, 72, and might be some listeners who I told to tune in who might remember that, but 71 or 72, Bill.
Yeah, I left. I had left.
You had gone, but I was at NCCU at the time, and I would go down, as we often did on Saturday night, to the chicken hut or chicken box and hang out in front of the A&P grocery store and eat chicken boxes with fried chicken and coleslaw and french fries, and some of the MOVE people would come through, and they were on Fayetteville Street all the time in Durham. Well, yeah, you never knew John Africa had a branch in Durham, huh?
I did not know that.
As a matter of fact, I think I saw one of his followers today. I was driving, and I saw the sister, and I said, oh, I think she was with John Africa, because I knew she used to be and looked like she's still around. I didn't get a chance to talk to her, like I said, I was just passing. But John Africa had a branch of the MOVE organization in Durham.
Why did he choose Durham? That's interesting.
That's very interesting. Matter of fact, maybe I can get more information on that.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I know where the sister I saw today, I know how to find her because I saw the neighborhood she lives in. I might go and try to see if I can find her because, yeah, she was a member of the MOVE organization.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah, right in Durham. You never heard that, huh?
Never heard that.
That's why you always try to get me on these programs.
That's exactly right, because you know. you got your fingers on the pulse.
Yeah, and they say been there, done that. But now, in terms of black political prisoners, when you look at probably the 20 most prominent political prisoners in the United States of America, about six or seven of them came out of the John Africa movement. And I'll mention their names in a minute, but these six or seven who came out of the John Africa movement were, I shouldn't say were, are incarcerated right now because of the death of a police officer during the time that Wilson Good dropped the bomb in Philadelphia on the move houses mm-hmm. in South Philadelphia. And so a police officer was killed, and this is not even, of course, during the time Mumia was not incarcerated. Mumia Abu-Jamal, who you mentioned earlier, he wasn't incarcerated until 1981. He was accused of killing the police officer Charles Faulkner in New York City. I mean, in Philadelphia in 1981.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, the MOVE organization and the people who are political prisoners now who are members of John Africa's organization, most of them went to jail in about 1978. And for example, I'm just going to mention some of them because oftentimes we forget.
Yeah, we do.
We forget. And the people I'm about to mention are African American people who have been jailed in the United States prison system for over at least 40 years. I want to make that because that's a long time.
Long time.
Delbert Orr was one. He was incarcerated in 1978, and Delbert Orr received 30 years to life for the killing of this police officer during the time of the MOVE organization bombing by Wilson Good. Then there was another one who's in the MOVE organization too, Eddie Goodman. He went in jail too, went to jail in 1978 for the same thing. Then there's a female, I want to mention too, oftentimes when people talk about incarceration, they talk about men in prison, but we have to realize that there are a lot of our sisters who are in prison too, that we can't forget.
Right.
And we forget oftentimes that many black women who are in jail. As a matter of fact, one in every 200 women in jail are black women. One in every 200 are black women. Are black women. And one in every 500 are non-black.
Hmm.
One out of every 200 women in prison are black. And one out of 500 are non-black. Just to show you the disparity in the whole prison system. And Janet Africa, also 1978, 30 years to life. She went to jail with the MOVE bombing. Janet Africa. And then there was another sister by the name of Janine Phillips, 30 years to life. And it was very interesting that all of these people who were involved in the MOVE movement, that's the amount of time they got, 30 years to life. 30 years to life. And there was another brother by the name of Chuck Sims, who went to jail in 1978 also for killing the same police officer. And I don't know how all these different people can kill the same police officer one time.
Right.
But they were all charged with the crime, you see. And that's another thing. When you look at the prison system, it's really very ignorantly laid out. You got six or seven people all charged with the same murder, and then oftentimes they give you time, 10 to 15 life sentences. I mean, come
right,
on. I
right.
mean, that's who's going to do? How you going to, you know? Right. And then you got Michael Africa, who also went to jail in 1978, and he was a member of the MOVE movement. And another very prominent brother who was sentenced to 60 years in prison and was supposed. See, we're still talking about political prisoners too. To those who just may have tuned in. But Brother Matula Shakur of the Black Liberation Army.
That's right.
Yeah, he received 60 years in prison. He's still in jail now and came up last April, I think it was, for parole. But he was denied parole, you see. And he was, of course, accused of bank robbery and also probably more significantly, he was accused of aiding in the breaking out of Assata Shakur, who is now in Cuba. You see, so Matula is still in jail. And then, of course, you have Sundiata Okoli, who went to jail in 1973. And he's about 88 years old right now. And he was, of course, with Matula Shakur and in prison in Maryland. He was involved allegedly with the release of Asada Shakur, Sundiata Okoli, and Matula Shakur. Then you have another brother from the Black Liberation Army too, named Joseph Bauer, who went in jail and went to jail in 1971. And I just found out too, which I'm really going to check on next week, that there's a brother who I hadn't heard of. This is another thing about our people who are incarcerated. They throw them in jail and we forget all about them. And that's the case. As I said before, I visited one of the few people who was allowed to visit Brother H-Rap Brown or Jamil El-Amin. And he would always tell me, he said, well, brother, one thing you can do whenever you go places to speak, whenever you have a forum on the radio, television, whatever the case may be, just mention my name, he said, because they want to write me out of history, and people want to forget me. And so I found out today that there's a brother in Butner Prison by the name of Aranza Bowers, who's an ex-member of the Black Panther Party, and he's supposed to be in prison. I could be to Butner Prison in about 20 minutes from where I am now, but I had never heard of him. So they want to throw our men and women away.
Let me ask you something. From this and from the standpoint of the carceral state, you know, you and I talked about this carceral idea, state idea. Why is that necessary to do that? What do you think? What is your perspective on that? Why is it necessary to that kind of mass incarceration of these political prisoners like that?
One thing you have to realize too, that even today, everybody who's in jail is not a political prisoner. But in early times, these men and women were placed in a confined, concealed, locked down state because they went against the system and the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it was. That's the way it began.
Of course, so is it a message? Are they sending a message?
Of course, they'll send a message in the same way that messages were sent when, as Billie Holiday talked about the strange fruit hanging from trees, when they would hang a black man or hang a black woman, or when they would hang a black man and then cut his testicles out and put it on postcards and take those testicles and put those testicles in vinegar and buy them and put them on their mantle. All of this was to show other fear. It's Willie Lynch talks about. Place fear in the minds and the hearts of other people in the slave community or the slave colony, however you want to look at, so that they will never do what this person did. And you see it actually extends over into our upbringing and our training in America, because our mothers would always tell us, don't do this or don't do that, because you'll end up in trouble. Or you end up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to control people through the mechanism of fear. And as a good example of that, I remember when I was in about the sixth grade, Bill, at Burton School. When you went to Lyon Park, I was at Burton. I went to Burton School, and one of the tours that our sixth grade teacher took us on was a tour of Central Prison in Raleigh.
Mm.
And the teachers took us to Central Prison, and when she took us up, we even got a chance to tour Death Row. And I'll never forget, and I remember the teacher's name. Her name was Miss Lenora Jeffers. She's in the grave now. But she said to us, she said to the class, and she pointed to the window where they had the electric chair. That's during the time they were using the electric chair before lethal injection.
Right.
And she said, she pointed to that chair through that that bulletproof glass. She said, this is where a lot of y'all, or some of y'all, she may have said, will end up if you don't follow instructions and if you don't follow orders.
Mm.
So as you talked about in your discussion of the carceral state, Foucault, and when he conceived this idea in France, as you said, you're absolutely correct. It was supposed to be a continuation of discipline, people, keeping people in check. And that's what the nature of the prison system
has been,
and that's what many people fear even today when it comes to prison. And that fear was put in us at an early age. I'll never forget, she told us that. So some of y'all going to end up right back there. And she pointed to the electric chair in Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Right. Yeah, I remember that using that prison thing as a way of frightening us about doing right and right behavior. I remember those years. I'm gonna take a quick break, Dr. Bridges, and I'm gonna come back, and I want to ask Brother Pugh if he could maybe tell us a little bit about that philosophical development of the incarcerated idea, that carceral idea that, you know, you found a lot of those guys writing the Russian Solzhenitsyn him and Dostoevsky, and they talked about those prisons and Michael Foucault, and looking at how all of that works from a philosophical perspective.
When you come back and go to Mr. Pugh, come back to me first if you don't mind, because I want to say something that relates to what I'm sure Dr. Pugh will say, and okay. It won't take me about 10 seconds, and then we can go straight to him.
Okay,
if you don't mind.
Okay, no problem. We're going to take a little musical break right here, and I want to say to our listening audience, and I really carefully want you to listen to this particular piece that we're going to play during the break, because it's very reflective of what's happening in the rap music industry. Because the rap music that you are hearing on a constant basis is not some of the real stuff that's being done. There are a lot of these young brothers that are very revolutionary in their approach, and they're writing music about liberation, but it doesn't get played because they'd rather you hear Cardi B and some of that garbage that they're playing. And I apologize to anybody that might be a Cardi B fan, but I'm sorry, that's garbage. But I want you to hear that this is some of the kinds of music that's been done. People like Dead Prez and folk like that are beginning to do it. And then we're going to come back, and I want Brother Pugh to tell us a little bit. But let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back.
We the people are the ones who are going to have to fight. We used to say, which side are you on? Which side are you on? The truth is, we're in so much debt that the only way out is revolution or war. So now the question is, which side are you on? On.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, my daughter? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
See, before I draw the line, let me welcome you close to all the folks who knew Obama, sold the people a hoax, gave the money to suckers while our community's still poor, withdrew the troops but started another war, colonizing, terrorizing, creating the oil crisis, so they can make a killer, no food and gas prices, prisons is filling, they trying to lock up the future, militarized borders and control of computers, rolling stupid bumping music that ain't healthy for the shortest, privatizing schools and policemen in the hallways, can't be dormant. I'm a broken rise up, be ready. Brought the family with us, and we hold the machetes.
Riding the fence. Too many people be riding the fence. Yeah, you say you ready for war, but are you convinced? I'm not convinced. If you're a rider, freedom fighter, crowd excited, then let's do this. We can make one big united middle finger to the U.S. Give me the bravest and the truest. Fuck the hippest and the coolest. We gon' spark this revolution and cross this off my to-do list. Put your foot down if you look down on this criminal system. Put your foot down and get shook down like my niggas in prison. Don't be condemning and condoning their actions in one sentence. Make up your mind and choose your side. Is you a patriot or a menace to society? So riot or sit by quietly. But don't pull out your flag and try to say you gon' ride with me. You flip-flopping like hip-hop. I don't get locked in that trick box. Get got like Big and Pop. Shit's got to stop. I am the people, not the big. I repeat after Fred. So please blow my brains out if I ever forget.
I'm with the independent thinkers. I'm down with the movers and the shakers and the ex-Henny drinkers. The non-smokers, the health advocates, the non-voters, the young bloods in the hood training like soldiers. I'm on the side of the cats with the hood guards. The little child that don't color inside the margins. I don't ride the fence, I cultivate my strength. Cause if it ain't about power, it don't make sense. I've been down with Boogie Down since BDP, some brown pride. And black power make RPG. An OG told me choose battles wisely. In the struggle, don't forget your children and your wife. If you don't see me on the podium preaching it, every day I hope my every action is teaching it. Cause revolution is a process, it's not a speech or a panel. You fight off more than you can handle.
Shout Yo, I still rock hard like slingshots in Palestina. Con todos los estudiantes por educación gratuita. I'm with workers uprising and the right to unionize. We ain't crossed the border, so you better legalize. I'm with La Peña del Bronx. I'm still with Vitor Toro. Cause gentrification is polluting my borough. So grown never, South Bronx forever. Decolonize the block, make your neighborhood better. I ain't down with the rich, I'm more Richie Perez. Don't talk to grand juries or cooperate with feds. I'm with students, doctors, journalists, teachers. We need level wages, but they don't believe us. Moneda, Barreto, Spofford, Hunts Point, my point, my hood. I love, we join forces, forming our deck, we ex. Taking over buildings, rapping kiosks for the children.
Politics to sickness, streets express symptoms. Caught up with a quickness, big business pimps them. Scholars play the simpleton, fools play with wisdom. Who will stand and fight back? We'll play the victim. Trials and tribulations, injured generations. Stolen history and outsourced innovation. Babel Tower fell, tribes are at war. The battle story's not represented in the score. The game's fixed, most of the faces and names switched. Credit stolen from art, science, religion, language. Technology, philosophy, and what strangers. They paid in hatred for the knowledge of the ancients. Power in words, actions, good swords. Old Panthers, brown berets, young lords. One sickness, one cure, one love, one blood, one world, but one war.
Listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
We're back with you, my brothers and sisters. We are talking about the Kosovo state, the police state that we operate in currently in this country. And we are looking at some of the parameters and trying to understand it as a community. What is it that we tell our children as they prepare themselves to become the next group of leaders? And that's what we are trying to do tonight. We are going to open up our lines. We are at call-in format, area code 215-490-9832 for any of you that are listening now via internet. That would like to call and give us your questions and statement. We're going to open up our lines. I want to do so very quickly. Before we do, I want to just make note of a couple of other programs that operate on the timeforanawakening.com network. On Monday, from 11 to 1 Eastern Time, my dear brother Oshiemi Adelabu has a program called African Perspective. We are so happy that brother Adelabu is he has been healing, and he is doing a lot better. And I talked to him earlier during the week, and so we hopefully that he will be. He actually will be starting his program back again. It is on now, it is as an archive, but we look forward to him coming back on live. So anyway, continually prayers for him that he will heal very quickly. So he has a program every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 1 Eastern Time, called African Perspective. And then on Monday from 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds by host Brother Jihad Ahmed. And then from 8 to 9 on Monday, Eastern Time, Black Therapy Central with the Queen Mother, Dr. Cambone, and Sister Nataki Cambone. From 8 to 9 on Time for an Awakening. And then on 9 to 10 on the first and third Mondays of every week, they have a program called Conversations and Reparations. Conversations and Reparations. And then on Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank, 7 to 9, 8 to 10 Eastern, right here with your host, myself. And then on Thursday, Sister Shani B., after 7, group of young millennials doing a magnificent and marvelous job of talking about things that are related to their group and their age system. Families, children, education, jobs, white folks, everything they're doing. So they're doing an excellent job. I I appreciate them, Brother Sister Shady B. Again, it's called After 7, 7 to 9 p.m., Eastern 6 to 8 Central, on Thursday, After 7 with host Shady B. And then on Friday, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, Time for an Awakening, 8 to 10 Eastern, 7 to 9 Central. Dynamic program, a lot of guests and hosts. And I was talking with Brother Elliot a couple of days ago. We got something exciting coming up. I'm not going to mention it right now, but there's exciting stuff on the way. And we really appreciate him and his vision that he has to make this platform available to the community to talk about those things that are very important for us. That's on Friday evening, 7 to 9, 8 to 10 Eastern Time Point Awakening. And then on Saturday from 4 to 6 Eastern, 3 to 5 Central, Black Sister Talk with my dear friend LaWanda Chambers. Black Sister Talk, same type of program. She is a psychotherapist. She looks at areas of concern in terms of mental health, stress, and trauma. Very dynamic program. And then following her is my dear brother, 6 to 8, 7 to 9 Eastern, the Elders of Sankofa, host of Brother Alfonso Watkins. Brother Watkins is also recuperating now. He has been ill for a while. He's been in the hospital. He's out doing better. I talked to him today. He sounds good and strong. He says he just needs to continue his rest. And he is going to be, he has broadcasts that have been playing for the last 2 weeks. And we just send our prayers and out to him and the ancestors to strengthen him and lift him up. And he can come on back and do what he does so well. Brother Alfonso Watkins, the Elders of Sankofa. And then on Sunday, Brother Richard and Brother Elliot back again at 7 to 9 Eastern, 6 to 8 Central, Time for an Awakening again with Brother Elliot. And so with that, I'm going to go back because I really want to get into this conversation. We're talking about the carceral state, looking at this prison system, how it works. As I indicated, it works like a machine. It's a huge machine, and everything that's operates for the central purpose of control and domination, as Dr. Bridges says, in this capitalist structure. And there are ways and things that we see being done that we, a lot of times, we don't even realize that they're being done for that reason. And so very clearly, we're trying to discuss some of those with you tonight so that you can have a clearance. So Dr. Bridges, you said you wanted to add something, as you did before I bring on Brother Pugh.
Yeah, and Brother Pugh would probably tie right into this, because if I'm correct, I think Brother Pugh is from down in Louisiana. Am I right?
Yeah, in Baton Rouge.
Exactly, and that's why I wanted to mention, before it goes on, I'll do it real quickly so you can get to him. In Louisiana, of course, the most notorious prison known there is a prison called Angola.
Angola.
Right, yeah. And I wanted to mention that. And Angola houses about 6,300 inmates and about 1,800 workers there. And it's the largest maximum security prison in the whole United States, named for the country of Angola, where most of the enslaved people came from who went to Louisiana on the plantations. And it was, as a matter of fact, a plantation, and it was transformed from a plantation into a prison complex. So I wanted to mention that about Angola, right. Named right. For the country of Angola in Louisiana. And then I'll mention some other things about briefly after you go to Dr. Pugh about Angola. Right. But I just wanted to mention that because I knew he's from Louisiana and he might want to mention Angola. And I knew a brother from Durham who was at Angola. Oh, man, I don't want to start it because that's a long story. He talked about what they had to do at Angola.
Yeah.
But okay, that's all. I just wanted to mention that.
Right. And then one more, Parchman's Farm out of Mississippi.
Right.
I don't know.
That's another
one. I can't remember the brother's name. Wrote a book called Worse Than Slavery. where he was talking about Parchman's Farm.
Yeah, uh-huh. Right, that's right. His brother, too, at the University of North Carolina, named William Ferris, who went down to the prisons and the houses on that plantation in Parchman, Mississippi, and got a lot of slave stories and rap and a lot of the music and that kind of thing that came from the churches in the whole Parchman prison area down in Mississippi. So You're absolutely right
about
that.
That's good. That's really good. You brought that up. I'm glad. And for our audience, as we're trying to explain to you what this carceral system is, that's one of the reasons why a lot of the television stations carry these stories about prisons. That's a part of the carceral system, to keep feeding you this information about these prisons. And I think right now there's, I think TLC, channel, the TLC channel and a couple of others, CNN, always got these programs about prisons. And they go down there and you see the inmates and see how they live, and they talk about the five worst prisons of America. That's a part of the carceral structure. It's to feed you.
That's
that.
Right.
Yeah, it's a part of how it works. Okay, Brother Pugh, what is your understanding of the philosophy, the philosophical development of this incarcerated or the carceral idea? What do you do? Do you have any thoughts along those lines? I mean, in reflections in terms of how that operates?
Well, good evening, Doctor, and good evening, Dr. Bridges.
Oh, hold up, my brother, I hope I introduced you pretty well, and you know, because I know you know about Angola.
well, no, actually, I'm ignorant. I have you know, I mean, I know I've heard the name Dostoevsky and a couple of his books, and Solzhenitsyn and Foucault, and another fellow, Jeremy Bentham, and his Panopticon. That's the basis of prison today. But I really know nothing about prisons, and I don't do any thought about that. But what I would want to do is, you mentioned MOVE, you mentioned the Nation of Islam, you mentioned
Black Panthers.
You mentioned the fact that you didn't think prisons could ever be, you know, gotten rid of. You mentioned some things, and so I'd like to say something briefly that speaks to that.
Okay, that's great. That's good. That's what we want.
Okay. Well, first of all, the prison industrial complex is about $1 trillion operation. The United States economy is about $20 trillion. So it's about it's about 5% of the U.S. economy. Now, at the time that slavery was ended in 1865, slavery dominated the American economy. It was well over 50% of the American economy.
Right.
So the notion that something that's only 5% of the economy is somehow or another just unshakable, unmovable, that is sort of belied by just the history just in this country. Second thing is that, you know, when Goldwater lost the election in 1964, the assumption was that the conservative movement was dead, that it was all over, and that the liberal variations of Republican liberalism and Democratic liberalism were on the ascendancy. Well, Donald Trump today represents the highest possible achievement of the conservative movement. So the notion that just because you lost, you know, in other words, there's a difference between battles and wars, and so the fact that you lost different battles don't mean that you lost the war. The third thing I'd like to speak to is MOVE and the Nation of Islam. Okay. You know, one of the things, you go down to Mississippi today and you see Chokwe Lumumba, who's running the city of Jackson. He comes out of the Republic of New Africa, right?
That's right, that's
you
right.
You see the Nation of Islam, they're viable, but MOVE is not viable. Well, what that tells you is this. That tells you that the problem with MOVE, and by the way, let me give my critique of MOVE. I think that the ideas of MOVE are the ideas of the Haitian Revolution are the key ideas for the world today. And the ideas of MOVE actually were the closest approximation of the ideas when the Haitians won the war as has ever been, other than traditional peoples. In other words, the MOVE was living closer to traditional people than any other people who've been exposed to, you know, these kind of modern societies. So I actually think that the MOVE has something to say to the world today. In other words, but the problem with MOVE is that MOVE didn't have no diplomacy, didn't have any politics. And you see it with the Nation of Islam. That, in other words, you've got an organization that recognizes that it's got to have relationships with other people, and it's got to maintain those relationships. You see it with the Republic of New Africa.
Right.
And I don't think that move did that.
Okay.
And I would say that, you know, I done shot my wire. That's it.
Right, exactly. And you know, and you're right about that, Brother Pugh, because even when you go back and you look at some of the legislation over the last four or five presidents, you see some stuff. Like even with Lyndon Johnson, when he came up with the war on crime. Now, we would think that would be something that's good for our community. That wasn't about being good for your community. That was about building the prison industrial complex in a way that would get some things done and passed without a lot of problems. And right after that, he passed this thing called the Law Enforcement Assistant Administration, which gave federal funds into state and local governments to buy these military-type weapons, and we kind of thought.
But that gets to say the Black Panther Party. That's politics. In other words, you got a situation where he was advancing his interests, and one of the things, remember, you know, Jesse Jackson. You know, you heard the expression that says that. I think I got it from you. Well, certainly I've heard you say it. That if you're not at the table, you the meal.
That's right.
And so what happens is these different politicians are trying to figure out what's in their best interest, and they were just using black people as pawns.
Right.
And so the ideal of somehow or another establishing that is just some kind of universal truth. I mean, if you look at Toussaint Louverture, one of the reasons that, one of the reasons that he was successful in his revolution was precisely because his ability to differentiate Europeans, that he was able to play them against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion of you looking at anything any white person did as some kind of monolithic overarching strategy that they all agree with, and if, you know, really that's not in our interest.
Right.
The reality is today that in fact one of the other statements you made is you said that. That they've sort of institutionalized the carceral strait into democracy, and you get people voting for it and so on. Well, the reason that you have voter suppression and gerrymandering and all of that is that if you look at the Pew polls that they have, you know, they'll tell you that most of the people in America mm-hmm. don't agree with current American policy. That's the reason that people like Donald Trump are doing stuff to prevent people from voting, period. Not just black people, white people.
White people
voting,
too, you're right.
They
right.
don't agree with the policy.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that somehow or another, if the American people are for black people being slaves, that's not true. And you know, that what happens is that you've got interest groups, and one of the things that interest groups do is they play the public. And so, in fact, one of the things that Trump is doing today is he goes to Kenosha or he goes to Portland, and he tries to induce white people to be afraid of this, that, or the other. And if he's successful, he can get a political result. If he's unsuccessful, he won't. But the notion of us believing that somehow or another this is just some inexorable thing associated with white people, that now to the end of time, their society has to have prisons. And one of the reasons that the Trump forces don't want any kind of political discussion of these things is that everybody recognizes that the whole ideal of prisons, the whole ideal of police, these are crimes. These
right.
are things that are not even necessary for human society.
Right.
And they're afraid that as more and more people become aware of these things and more people become less afraid, you know, in the sense of being brainwashed by these cop shows and stuff on TV, that they will begin, if they have a vote, they'll begin to use their vote to reflect that. And that's one of the reasons they want to get rid of the possibility of people voting. And Trump put in, you know, these kind of, in fact, today yesterday in the Washington Post, and I'm going to end with this. Yesterday in the Washington Post, there's an article, and it says, how did it go? I posted it on Facebook, the article. But what it basically says is that Trump is talking about the rule of law. I forgot because it was clever the way he put it. But the bottom line is that Trump is talking about a rule of law when it ain't no law at all. In other words, he wants to go back to the Leviathan that you talked about with Hobbes, where this ruler had absolute authority.
Right.
That's what Trump means when he says that when you're protesting, you're wrong because the state, anything the state does is right. And so for you to be protesting that, then that means you're violating the state. So what I'm saying is that they're aware of the fact that most of the people in this country don't agree with their policies. Most of the Republicans don't even agree with their policies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason that they're increasingly diminishing the capacity of people
of
who don't agree with them
right.
to even have anything to say about this society. Now, we can play on that if we're aware of it. But if, on the other hand, we blow them up to be more than what they are, then, you know, we will essentially disempower ourselves.
Thank you so much, Brother Pugh. I appreciate that. That's exactly what we're trying to do here tonight, is to sort of reveal some of that behavior and the things that we're talking about. I've got a sister online. I want to ask her a question because I know she's working. She has a young warrior that she is preparing, and he's getting ready to enter the music industry. He's a very conscious musician, and he's going to do some things, but meanwhile, she has a better hand on the idea of a lot of these conscious rappers. You've got a lot of conscious rappers out here that we don't know about. And the reason that we don't know about them is because obviously they're not being promoted. Like I said, the Cardi B's and all of that group is being promoted. I'll give an example, like the group Dead Prez. These brothers are laying it out. They're talking about the police state. And they're creating music around the police state, and they're being joined by folk like Chuck D, who was out there a long time ago, but he's still influencing a lot of them. So I wanted to ask her a little bit about what she knows, because I know she's working with her son to get him into that conscious music. Who is this behind the conscious rap music industry? Who are these young folk being influenced by? Even the brother J. Cole. J. Cole is a really real conscious rapper. Who are they being influenced by, and what is the state of that their music right now in getting out into the American public? Sister.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Rogers, for just bringing me into the conversation. And you know how important music is. Music is the universal language. So it's extremely important. Now your question is who is influencing? And to be honest with you, all rappers, all artists, period, are influenced by what's going on in the world. It's just that they choose to tell the stories in different ways.
Okay.
The problem is that the money is behind those who are feeding destruction. They will not put in money to get behind those who are trying to feed the public hope and life and health and wealth and well-being. So it's very strategic. And when my son, a couple years ago, some people heard him in the industry, and they told him, they said, if you would make a song for the strip club, you'll be on overnight. Because he really is
now?
Very good for the strip club.
Oh, strip club. Okay. Right.
Yes. Because he really is a very good artist, you know, and he's been groomed since a child for, you know, the stage. He started out playing drums in the church when he was 3 years old. And now he's 23. And so, it's always been a part of their life. Now, who influences him? Now, that's his inspiration comes from what he sees going on in the world. His inspiration comes from, like, today I was listening to something that he wrote. He just got back from California today. And I was listening to something he was working on with the producers out there. And it's talking about exactly what we're seeing going on in Kenosha, you know, and it's talking about mothers crying over their sons, you know, and he's written things just talking about telling young girls, you don't have to be bees and hoes, and you don't have to be having sex when you 15 and 16 years old. But they don't put money behind things like that because it's opposite of what the true agenda is for black people, because they have to keep recirculating this destructive behavior. And music is extremely influencing, influential. You think about it, even back in the 70s, and you think about the music, you know, that brought life, and Bob Marley, and, you know, One Love, and all those kinds of, and it released an energy of love. It'd be because you get so many people who come together on that same vibration, you know, and it's the same thing when you hear a bunch of cars driving down the street and they have that loud vibration, that loud music vibrating. And you think about how many people, if the radio is on a specific channel, 97.9 The Beat, and if you got millions of people listening to this and you're feeding destruction at one time, and if you get just a small percentage of individuals who are tuning in at the same time, all singing this same thing at the same time, that's still a real, that's an energy that's coming together that's bringing that destruction. And then that is placed in specific areas in the community, because we're pretty much, black folks live with black folks, white folks live with white folks. Hey, that's just the way it is now, you know, for the most part, you know, not everywhere, but for the most part. So think about it. You get in the inner city, and you got blocks and blocks of this music playing. Depending on the message that it's putting out there, that's all of that going out into the universe at one time. And people are collectively coming together, even if they're just sitting on their porches, and they're singing destruction, and they're releasing that into the air, but it's strategic.
Right.
And that's why
exactly.
They won't put the money behind, because they don't want to empower our people the same as they want to use that music to bring destruction.
Okay. Right, and that's always been
controlled. I'm not sure if that's what you were looking for. You know, you asked me about the influences. Like, I know the people who influenced him as far as music, it's just based on the messages. But the messages come from what's going on in the world. It's just they choose which lane they want to go down.
Exactly. And you know, there's evidence that has been, has come forward lately, that Bob Marley, that's what happened to him in several situations. Once where he was shot, then it was attempted to poison him, then somebody tried to poison him, and there was a lot of it to control that music and what he was saying, and his refusal to back down from the words. So you're right. I mean, that music is powerful. It's a powerful entity.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you so much. I wanted to find that because I'm just impressed with some of this stuff that I've seen that I didn't even know was there when I was looking for music to.
There are a lot of conscious artists out there, but unfortunately, the majority of them will never be heard.
They will never be heard. That's amazing.
Because they're not going to put the money behind them, because they don't want to heal the land like
right.
that. You know,
right.
it costs money. Take money out of the pockets. If you got somebody rapping about being high all the time, well, that's keeping that money going, you know.
Okay.
So if you got somebody rapping about shooting and killing, well, that's keeping the gun selling, and that's keeping that industry going, that crime scene going. So that's unfortunately, it's up to us to decide.
Right.
What
and so that that feeds into that carceral state system that we keep talking about is
right.
they support where they want these young boys killing each other, you know, so that
right.
Right, keeps that going. Well, thank you so much, Sister Lotus. I appreciate that.
You are welcome. Thank
right.
you.
Brother Timothy.
And if it's okay with you, Dr. Rogers, I drop a link for one of his very political songs and videos called Nations that he did, and it addresses that. It addresses how the media will get behind people, and he specifically talks about like Cardi B and some of the
okay
the other,
yeah do that make sure you do that
and I'll drop it on the okay sure
make
will.
Sure you do that brother Timothy we've been talking about your hometown brother Bridges and Dr. Bridges and myself and brother Pugh we've been talking a lot about MOVE there's a sister her name is Taja Ibram she's out of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. She has done an extensive amount of research on the organization MOVE, which is one of the places that I was sharing some of the information with you. She wrote an essay not too long ago called Can't Jail the Revolution, Policing, Protests, and the MOVE Organization in Philadelphia's Carceral Landscape. Brother Timothy, what you know about MOVE? And we talked about them street. How has that affected your understanding? Is that still around Philadelphia, the idea of that? I know the neighborhood's still there, even though it's bombed out. But what do you know? What can you tell us about MOVE?
Well, I'm going to tell you about the spirit of MOVE. The spirit of MOVE did not break through the police establishment and the system. I'll give you an example. I remember in 1978, when I was a junior in high school, I used to go to a club called Hotel Philadelphia. And the first MOVE compound was on Palton Avenue. They called that Palton Village. And I could drive my car to that club at night, and I would ride past the compound when to go to the club and come back in the same direction. And MOVE would be sitting on the outside of the compound, or they'd be leaning against the compound. It looked like a fortress on Palton Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And they did positive things. Let me give you some of the things. To make money, they washed cars. They did a lot of things to make money that was legitimate. They sold fruit. They did a lot of interesting things. That was in the Palton Village, and they had a guy in there whose name was Conrad, real strong guy, and Delbert Africa. And he's something else, Delbert. Now
he's the one I mentioned.
That's right. Let me tell you about Delbert and Conrad. Both of them were real strong men, and they did something in '78 that was different. Because we had went from wearing bushes to wearing our hair close. We called it the hustler, right? We wearing our hair close, and if you didn't have wavy hair, you would get some Murray's hair, or some people get some Luminous and put some waves in there. But MOVE was dreading their hair. In 1977, 78, MOVE was dreading their hair, right? They were eating vegetables. They believed in eating garlic and onion raw. And the things that they did that was different, they were ahead of their time with it, they homeschooled.
Mm-hmm. Now, right,
now,
that's true.
Here's the thing. This is how MOVE started in Philadelphia with Don Africa. They first started out, I remember, protesting the zoo. The zoo was right near that area of Palton Village. And they said they didn't think the animals should be locked up. So they were protesting in front of the zoo. They did some interesting things, man. So they went from protesting the zoo, protesting the politicians, and that's how they got the attention from the police. The protesting the judges and the politicians in the city hall. And they went down there, they would go to the court, they were in front of city hall, and they did something that was interesting with their head dreaded. And they were different to the cops. And I want to say that the cops were afraid of them, but they thought they were different, they were vocal, and they would have their blowhorns. Now, wait a minute now. Rizzo was the commissioner of police.
Yeah, I remember
at the
Rizzo.
Time, mm-hmm. That's right. Rizzo was the commissioner of police at the time. And Rizzo had a hard on them. He had a hard on for them because they stood up to the police. They didn't like the corruption in the city. And they were an example where people said, well, the way they stand up to the police, I don't mind fighting the police. Now, here's the thing. Their psychological warfare is what got the police. They would say things to the police, and the police would make you, we'd say, whoa, man. You know what I'm saying? Something mm-hmm. like when Malcolm came along. Mm-hmm. Malcolm was different. What Malcolm said vocally made people stand up like, whoa. But it when they had the hard on they had for the police is that they would ride past the compound and the police would pick at them. They didn't wait for the police to they would pick at them and MOVE would give it to them right back. It got to the point where they came and wanted to get them out of the compound. And MOVE had a standoff. It was on television. And MOVE had a standoff, and MOVE was not leaving the compound. And they gave them a certain, this is the first one in 78. They gave them a certain amount of time to get out, and they didn't come out. Everybody that I knew that was down there had guns. This is the truth. They had guns, right? Now, but if MOVE had guns, I wasn't there. People tell me they never fired a shot. But the cops were shooting at the compound, and the officer was hit by friendly fire. So when he went down, at that point, they came in the compound, tear gas, and water hoses. Now listen to this. They dubbed Africa and came out. And you know what? You know how you see Rodney King? He was beat up by the police. That was the first one I saw do that. They kicked Delbert Alpha's head like a football down the street. He was the first one. But I never seen nothing like that before in a high school. This was before Rodney King, right? The second incident is now I'm in undergrad. I'll never forget that. I'm in undergrad, and I'm getting ready to come out, right? And MOVE is in on 62nd Osage Avenue, and they owned the house. The problem was that the neighbors complained about the MOVE getting up in the morning, using their blow horns. They built another fortress. They put a bunker on the house. See, it started with the neighbors. If the Bailiffs would have had a better connection with MOVE, it might have turned out better. All the police wanted to do was wait for somebody to complain about them.
Right.
And when they start complaining about them, you had Ramona Africa in there, and you had Birdie. And they had children in there, men and women, and they had John Africa in there. They were not going to drop that C4 on compound, not as John Africa. They had to get John Africa. Once they knew he was in there, and they had a standoff, they gave them time to get out. They said, "We want you out." We said, we're not coming out. And different politicians were trying to negotiate. And Wilson Good was one of them. They tried to negotiate with MOVE, right? And they wouldn't come out. They wouldn't come out.
Well, see, that's the tactic, is that you demonize them first. You got to demonize them.
Exactly. Exactly. They were different. They dreaded their hair. They homeschooled their children. They ate vegetables. All those kind of things. They said they lived with rats. They didn't live with rats. They may have got all kinds of stuff on them. That was exactly right. So you're saying, Dr. Rogers?
Yeah, demonize them.
What the city of Philadelphia had with Wilson Good, because Rizzo had died. He was gone. He tried to run the third time against Good. Good beat him. Now he tried to beat Good back. Rizzo died.
Right.
He had somebody, he had military people working for him. That's how they got that bomb. So Wilson Good, they had something that was just going to take the bunker down. And they lied to him. And what they did was once they dropped the bomb, tear gassed it, what they did was Ramona and Birdie tried to get out. Now listen to this. They kept firing in the alley. One cop said, "I'm not going to go." When he let them go, Ramona was on fire and so was Birdie. But he came out. Guess what? When that cop let them go, he caught hell. They were all kinds of nasty to soccer,
sugar
love and all that kind of stuff. And guess what? He left. He had to go. Because he went against that establishment. Okay, and that's when they dropped that C4.
Right.
And I'm gonna talk about the corruption of the police, but I'm also gonna talk about the DA, because I'm gonna give you an example. Do you know what's going on with Crump and Breonna Taylor? You know that case?
Go ahead.
Me tell you what Crump found out about this case. They're trying to make her ex boyfriend say she was involved in drugs, and they said if you say she was involved in drugs, that'll help us.
Right.
Clear this case up.
Yeah, that's the demonizing piece. Yeah, you got to demonize
it. Exactly. And guess what?
Right.
Guess what? It's not working.
Yeah.
See how the inside of corruption works. Demonize to get him out the way.
Yeah.
Like I said, MOVE started progressing the corruption of judges and politicians.
Yeah.
And it went from that to fighting the cops mentally, to fighting them physically, to the cops shooting to dropping a bomb on them.
Right.
Now, what they're doing with Breonna Taylor and Crump is they're going to beat that case, but they're trying to find a way to find something on that girl. Is this like Floyd? They talked about when, unfortunately, how that cop was on his neck. They tried to say, Floyd was on, he used drugs, he was on alcohol. I don't care, if he would have snorted cocaine 5 minutes before the cop put his knee on his neck, that wouldn't have meant nothing.
The same thing with the brother in Kenosha. They tried to say he was doing stuff that you know, same thing. They did all kind of, and then what happens is some people in the community buy into that. And they say,
they,
you know, they shouldn't do that. And, you know, it's a system that, you know, very clearly works and designed to do that. Any politician that runs for office, if he goes up against an anti-police platform, he's out. He's through. He won't make it. So that's why the first one thing a lot of them do is to go to that law and order, even if it's soft tone, like Biden did the other day. Biden didn't attack the police. He talked about let's work together more peacefully, but he did. He didn't attack that. He didn't go up against that. What was going on in Kenosha? He just said something about we hate losing lives and things like that. You know, he soft pedaled it, but he didn't attack it. No way. If we do, we won't make it to do that. Let me run over here to Brother Lush. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight? What's some of your thoughts about the police?
Good evening. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening, everyone. And I'm just learning. I'm just learning. I'm sitting here listening from Dr. Bridges and you and Brother Pugh, and I really would have one little small request, if it's at all possible, to get Sister Lotus's son, if there's maybe a YouTube piece or some other piece. I would love to listen to some of his work.
Okay, yeah, she's still on, Brother Sister Lotus.
I will
Lotus.
Definitely do. Thank you so much. I actually will drop it on the link for tonight's show, if that's okay with Dr. Rogers. On his Facebook, I'll do that now, and then Dr. Rogers will have the link as well. He has a real powerful piece called Nations that they were actually, he was going to perform it for the DNC this year, but, you know, of course it was canceled, but I will be happy to drop that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Sister Yan, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing okay. Greetings, peace, and love to everybody. How you doing, Doc?
All right. How you doing? Good. Doing great.
Ain't that right? Brother Bruce, how are you?
I'm all right, sister. Wish we had more time on this program.
I know. I do, too. Unfortunately, we don't. But
listen, I'm going to be real quick because I know time is getting close. Dr. Rogers, your introduction.
Yes.
It's just extremely powerful.
Thank you.
And I really wish that we have focused more, I'm just being honest, on that introduction.
Okay.
Everything that you laid out was real.
That's right.
I mean, it's the reality that black people have a real hard time facing. When you said it's not going to stop all this killing and all this murder by police, is not going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us have a hard time facing that. So we talk about politics and we talk about, you know, other parts of culture, whatever. But the reality is that we're in the midst of a genocide.
Yes, we are.
This is the purge. And it bothers me deeply that we're not organizing, that we're not unifying on the level that we did in the 60s when, you know, we were being terrorized. And we've always been terrorized, but, you know, we should be doing so much more than we're doing now. Our young people, you asked about what we should say to our youth, Doc, and a lot of them are just, all they know to do is protest, and they don't understand that that's not going to get them anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have meetings with politicians and whatnot. They just get to run around, and the leaders get killed off. It is the same cycle, you know, generation after generation after century. But I want to throw this in real quick.
Okay.
Because the police are doing just what they were, as you said in the beginning, what they were created to do. They're created to practice organized violence, to organize violence. That's their purpose.
That's
and it's
right.
The core of state power. So they've got to have that.
Mm-hmm.
But yesterday I was looking at something. I don't know if anybody saw this or heard about this, but there's this drug called ketamine. And what they're doing now is pulling over black men or cops, police are accosting black men on the street. And when the brother's not resisting, he's not, you know, putting up a fight or anything, they're saying, and this was caught on camera twice, oh, look at him. He's too hard to handle. He's putting up a fight. And you can see them right on camera lying and saying that a black man is putting up a fight when the man is on the ground lying still after he's been tased. They then called the first responders and forced the first responders to inject them with ketamine, which is an anesthetic that is used in some serious surgery, so it paralyzes the body.
Mm-hmm.
The person is conscious, but you're paralyzed. And they are forcefully injecting black men with ketamine. Several have died, so it is murder by ketamine, by drugs. And one brother, he almost died, so he lived to talk about what they did to him, you know, on this program that I saw last night. So they keep on coming up with ways to kill black men or lock them away.
Right. Exactly.
And when I heard about this, it just really sealed it for me. You know, we can talk about this and that and that and this, but they're trying to kill black men off, and we have got to do something.
Yes, that's what I'm talking
We've
about.
We've got to do something.
And that's the discussion.
So everybody remember this, because this is the next thing.
Yeah, that's it. That's
And one other thing, there was a white EMT worker that they were trying to force to inject this ketamine and kill a black man. And the guy refused. He said, this is not medically necessary. So, of course, he lost his job, and they're going after him. So that's how serious they are about taking us out. Mm-hmm. And that is the cold, hard truth.
That's the fact. That's the fucking fact. Brother Griffin, I noticed you had responded to a lot of things on the conversation board here. You want to mention any of those? We don't have a lot of time. So you want to mention a few things that you think might be of interest for us? I know you were questioning something about that C4 stuff that they used in the MOVE bombing.
Well, can you hear me?
Yeah,
good
I can.
Evening, sir.
I can hear you.
I'll just make it quick. We talked about this on Time Before Awakening. I happen to have come out of the Air Force, and I know in 1985, that wasn't just a local decision. The ATF and FBI supplied that C4 and Tovex TR2 that was dropped by Wilson Good. I talked about it on Brother Elliot's show, and I don't just say things to be making supposition. That was not just a local decision. Reagan's ATF and FBI were the ones who supplied the C4. So that tells you this was not just a random local thing. The federal government made that decision to isolate MOVE for a lot of the reasons that y'all have been talking about.
Right.
The other thing is, when I heard Brother Pugh talking about how the GOP transformed itself, there's not just one power of lever of power that was going on here, because Lewis Powell actually, if you read the Powell memo or the Powell manifesto, you'll find out that that was corporate takeover of government that end up leading us to where we are now, because it ends up isolating true voting. That's one of the reasons you got somebody like Greg Palast that can go around for 10 or 11 years talking about what's wrong with voter suppression, and neither one of the parties did anything about it. So the idea was to stop the populist or the vote from the people mattering. In other words, you cast a ballot, but there's 15 different ways, because of states' rights, for your ballot to never be counted. I stopped there. I put a lot of stuff on Knowledge for Power, but I'm telling you, you don't have to suppose anything with this. If you do the research, you can extrapolate and get the truth.
That's true.
And like I said, the federal government made the determination to ice MOVE. That was not just Wilson Good, even though he was a willful idiot.
Right.
Stop there. And
that's the thing that we want. That's a good way to end tonight's discussion. Is that's the whole idea, is to say that these are not individual factors. This is the federal system. This is the machine. This is the Leviathan. This is the carceral state that works on an international level. And don't think that organizations like Interpol and organizations like the British police and the Israeli police don't get involved into local American things that might have some impact on who they are and what they're trying to do. And that's the thing we want you to understand as we get out here,
Dr.
and we
Rogers,
protest.
I'll
come to you in just a second.
That's another reason when the other brother, I forgot his name, talked about MOVE being in North Carolina.
Yes.
That was why the federal government got involved, because even here in the Tidewater area where I live in Virginia, there were MOVE groups.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, Dr. Bridges, take us home. I'll let you say any closing thoughts you have. We got only a few minutes left.
No, I just wanted to say that just yesterday I heard a lecture by Linton Kwesi Johnson, and he is a rapper or poet who was out in the 60s, but he always had conscious poetry. And he said something that the sister made me think about in her discussion, the one who has a son who's a rapper. And Linton Kwesi Johnson says that there's no poetry, no dance, no art, no music that's just for sake. Everything that's done in this country must be done for a political sake. And he says that when people begin to hear the music, begin to see the dance, and when they begin to understand the narratives that talk about slavery, when those things hit their minds, next those minds have to transfer those thoughts into action, as Sister Beniswa says, and begin to take action. So in other words, wherever people become aware, they begin to stand up.
Okay.
But the awareness comes first.
That's right. It's 9 o'clock. So with that, we'll let Killer Mike take us home.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yeah.
You know what? Fuck the
Immortal Technique. Killer Mike. Like a prison with invisible bars. No matter where you at, it always follows you where you are. And it's hard out there for a pimp to get out of, but it's harder for the hook that I need beat the shit out of. I got niggas underground in the Confederate States, ironically running from slavery that prison creates. So I never hate on the South, I respect their vision. I just hate on niggas that promote Samboism and white execs that love to see us in that position. They reflect the stereotypes of America's vision. They want us dancing, cooning and hollering, only respect us for playing sports and modeling. More than racism, it's stay in your racism. All people are trapped in practical black racism. So fuck a civil war between the North and the South. It's between fields, niggas and slaves that are stuck in the house.
Civil war for the soul of a nation. This is a struggle to save civilization. Demonstrations overthrowing the occupation, the annihilation of mental colonization. Civil war for the soul of a nation. We fight for the future of our civilization. Destroying corrupt government organizations, trying to survive cultural assassination.
Rip niggas, blood niggas, essays, Asians. Why the fuck we born with each other's population? The devil wanna dead all our population, people and folk nation. Why the separation? Why we got Jamaicans hating on Haitians? When the British and French rape both nations, Mexicans and blacks kill each other straight hating. Why the government profits from prison population? If you on the bottom, be you Anglo or Asian, you gotta recognize the realness in what I'm saying. You gotta recognize another sheep ain't the enemy. When the police ride and kill us frequently, we gotta make the youth see where the truth be. If you achieve, then grow and develop GP. 50 years of gains and our people still poor. If we really run the streets, we should really end war.
Civil war for the soul of a nation. This is a struggle to save civilization. Demonstrations overthrowing the occupation, the annihilation of mental colonization. Civil war for the soul of a nation. We fight for the future of our civilization. Destroying corrupt government organizations, trying to survive